This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In 1964, prehistoric remains were discovered at Jabal as-Sahaba, or Mountain of the Companions, in the Nile Valley near what is now the border of northern Sudan and Egypt. That site contained evidence of the earliest known warfare believed to have taken place around 13,500 years ago. It's thought that climate change led to that conflict as crop yields became smaller, more groups had to compete with each other for what food sources were available. Spears and possibly arrows were the high-tech weapons of choice in the Nile Valley. Flash forward to today, and it's AI-enabled drones that have been almost literally levelling the playing field for Ukraine in their battle against Russia. But as technological advancement gathers pace, what lessons have we learned from the recent conflicts, and how might things change in the wars regrettably yet to come? Step inside the briefing room, today in front of an audience at the Radio Theatre here at BBC HQ in Portland Place, London, and together we'll find out. Now, normally I introduce my guests, but as they're all here at the same time, I think I'll get them to do it themselves.
I'm Dr. Jack Watling. I'm the Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare at the Royal United Services Institute.
I'm Dr. Emma Salisbury. I'm the Associate Fellow in Military Innovation at the Council on Geostrategy.
I'm Shashank Joshi. I'm Defence Editor at The Economist in London, where I cover national security, defence and all the other bad things happening in the world.
Now, if we took a soldier who was part of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and we transported them to a battlefield today, just how different would they find it? Jack Watling.
I think there are many things that would be continuities, but there are also very dramatic changes. And one of the most easy to visualise is that if you got shot at in 2003 going into Iraq and got down on your belt buckle lying on your stomach, your horizon would collapse. Whether it was even relatively limited vegetation or dust, you wouldn't be able to see very far. And you would need to work out what was going on by talking to the people near you. Whereas today, when you get down into cover and you open up the tablet, essentially, that you are wearing on your chest, you can draw in information from up to 25 drones that are operating around you, and you can see whatever you want to. Now, what you choose to look at, which drone you actually choose to see through, will determine whether you get the right information. So you need to make choices, but you have a massive amount of information and situational awareness that you're drawing upon. And also, you can reach out and strike people who are hiding behind objects or who would have previously been concealed because you can see them with thermal cameras and other things. And so you're not really safe anywhere either, which is another quite significant psychological change in terms of how soldiers experience combat.
Emma.
I think that also extends to the sea as well. It's the same thing with the amount of information and the amount of sensors that are available to you as a ship commander. Because it used to be that you could hide in the sea very easily. If you were far away, people couldn't see you, especially if you're in a submarine under the water. But nowadays, there are so many sensors, so much information. There is very, very little place to hide. And I think that is the biggest difference that you'd see in the last 20 years.
Shashank.
Let me elaborate on both those points. I remember asking Mick Ryan, an Australian Major General who was in Iraq and then ran Australia's Defence College, what it was like and what the differences were. And he said, in Iraq, if we saw something above us, if we felt we were observed by something, We had perhaps 15 minutes to pack up and leave and get gone, depending, of course, on who was firing at you, who was watching you. In Ukraine, given the density of things watching you from the sky, from the air, from the ground, other sensors maybe picking up your electronic emissions, you could have minutes, depending on the drone watching you, depending on the responsiveness of fire. And so what's interesting is not just that lethality, that constant sense of jeopardy, that threat, but what effect that has had on the organization of armies on the ground. And so we see armies being forced to disperse. We see them forced to move much more quickly. They can't concentrate as much as they did. It's changed the shape of the battlefield.
Can I push you a little bit on that last point? If you can't concentrate, I mean, if you remember, the great battles have been fought by people forming up formations at certain critical points in order to push through the enemy line. Are you saying that that's a much more hazardous business than it ever was?
It's much more hazardous. It's much more liable to get you spotted, and it's much more liable to get you killed if you're struck. And of course, what that also means, a corollary, is that it's difficult to concentrate to attack. We see this in many places, but particularly acutely in Ukraine, is that both sides are being forced to fight at relatively low levels of formations, perhaps companies, certainly not the big formations that you might have expected in your head if you're thinking of Cold War battles between the Warsaw Pact and NATO.
Shashank, you've taken us to Ukraine, and I wanted to actually look at that in a bit more detail because it's the biggest clash of arms, what, since Iraq in 2003 and the biggest in Europe since 1945. And it's incredible when you think there are only two protagonists actually in the field. So what do we think we've learned from that, in addition to the things that Shashank has been saying, that we didn't already know? Or what do we need to relearn that we've forgotten, Jack?
I think the biggest thing that's emerging for professional militaries is the criticality of electronic warfare. People don't tend to talk about it because you can't see it. But we used to have analog systems. A radio communicates on a certain frequency and you can jam it by pushing electrical energy at that radio, suppressing, saturating its receiver so that it's jammed. Fine. But now we're dealing with software-defined systems. And so you can reprogram it and it will use a whole different set of frequencies. And if the adversary can chase you around the spectrum, they can disrupt whether the information you're receiving is accurate or not. Even the ability to understand, I can see something, can I actually determine where it is accurately? Or is the GPS signal being moved slightly so that when I tell the artillery where it is, they strike the wrong location? The ability to not just ingest a huge amount of information, but to actually validate that that information is accurate is becoming fundamental to how forces fight and to their efficiency and effectiveness. And this is ultimately enabled by the distribution of computers across the battlefield.
Emma, it's been mostly a land war in Ukraine, of course, and you're a naval expert, but I imagine that you've been picking up lessons as well.
Absolutely. I think the big lesson from Ukraine for the Navy experts of the world is that you don't actually need a big traditional surface Navy to make an impact on the water. And what we've seen with Ukraine and the Black Sea is they, without having a traditional Navy, they've been able to kill these big ships that the Russians have had in the Black Sea with missiles, with small uncrewed vessels on the surface. And I think that is something that's going to be carried forward because you see ships, traditional ships like the big US destroyers, they are being threatened by missiles and by smaller uncrewed vessels. And that kind of threat to them is completely new and something that will continue.
Shashank Joshi.
I remember asking a British general about this and he said, Interflex, which is a name we give to our training program for Ukrainians, we've learnt as much from it as they have from us. And the example he gave was digging. Right, digging trenches, digging command posts. In Iraq and Afghanistan, we, the UK, the United States, had big hardened command posts with antennas everywhere, big targets, because no one was really firing at you apart from mortars that you could take out. That's all changed. Ukrainians have to dig all the time to survive in that environment we've just been discussing. And he said to me, they have elevated the standard of our digging, because that's not something we spent a huge amount of time thinking about, or if we did, prioritizing and inculcating in soldiers in the past. Incredibly low tech that would be familiar to anyone from a battlefield 120 years ago, but nonetheless of enduring, vital, indispensable importance.
Let's move on from Ukraine to the situation in Gaza and the Middle East. Entirely different kind of conflict. Jack, what do you observe about those conflicts that you think teach us lessons, new lessons?
I think there is a massive challenge exposed, not just in Gaza at the moment, but previously in Mosul and in Raqqa, which is that when you have forces that gain, shall we say, sensor dominance, right? They have all of those cameras and the ability to detect things. The force that is losing that sensor fight retreats into complicated terrain, environments where it's hard to be found. And invariably, that's cities. So turning your tactical success into operational success, achieving the defeat of the enemy, increasingly requires you to be able to seize cities. The problem, of course, is that firstly, that is very, very intensive in terms of the number of people that it takes and the number of munitions required. But cities are also places that we want to preserve because there are huge numbers of civilians that live there. And so how militaries prepare and train to fight efficiently in an urban environment is going to be very important in the future, of increasing importance.
Do you think that lesson is being learned at the moment?
There is a lot of effort going into trying to work out how we communicate in an urban environment, how we discriminate where civilians are and where they are not, and then how do you clear spaces without having to expose your own troops to have to methodically go through every single bit of terrain. But the reality is that we have not found a good set of solutions to that problem, which is why when you look at fights happening in urban areas, there is utter devastation. You know, that is the tragic consequence of the culmination of battles.
Well, what people have been seeing is war from the air on a city area, in the case of Gaza, in which entire buildings are taken out. And I suppose the imagination was amongst some people that somehow or other there would be more precise weaponry that would take out people in a room in a building. Shashank.
I think the fascinating thing is if you look at the first week of the Israeli war in Gaza, the overwhelming majority of munitions that were used were precision guided, one form or another, GPS guided or laser guided or something else. By December or so, the public estimate for the proportion was about 40 to 45% were old-fashioned dumb munitions. And I think what that tells us is that even if you're an army like the IDF that has been buying huge numbers of precision bombs from the United States and other countries, in a war of that scale, you may run short that you'll never have enough precision-guided munitions to attack all the targets you want. And you'll be holding some back for other contingencies. That could be a war with Iran. That could be a war with Hezbollah. And so I think this comes back to that initial point about precision. Yes, war is more precise. Yes, we can hit things with extraordinary accuracy. We will never have enough high-end, expensive, very scarce, complex munitions to attack all targets in that way. There will always be a need for mass firepower that goes in a regressive way back to unguided, dumb munitions.
And let's look a bit at the other part of the conflict within the Middle East, which is, for many people, the most unexpected, which is that a group of people in Yemen who have sympathy, they say, with people in Gaza, are able to do things on a major shipping highway. Can you take us through what we should learn from that?
I think the really important thing to take from this is that a non-state actor with relatively little budget can buy cheap munitions, cheap drones, and threaten international shipping. And when you look at the military response we've seen from the UK, the US, and other partners, the cost difference between what the Houthis are hitting us with and what we are hitting back with is vast. So the Houthis can use a drone that costs maybe $3,000. And if that hits, that's going to do some damage. It's not going to hit a ship and completely sink it, but it's going to do damage that you don't want to be done. But then to shoot that down, you're using a missile that costs $3 million. So the Houthis can create a huge amount of trouble for international shipping at a low cost.
Shashank.
It's also worth noting what you get for the money you spend. The ballistic missiles that a country like Iran was firing in the early 1990s had a circular error probable. So in other words, a measure of the missile's accuracy. Half the missiles would fall within the radius of about hundreds of meters. Really, really indiscriminate weapons. You could fire them vaguely at cities to terrorize people. You were not hitting a single building. the missiles that Iran is building and then giving to groups like the Houthis and its other allies in the region, in some cases, when they can get a good satellite signal, have accuracy levels of a couple of meters. And we saw that when they struck an American air base in January 2020, hitting hardened shelters one by one, six of them in a row. And so it's not just who has these weapons, it's not just the cost, it's the level of precision per dollar you spend is now remarkable and in the hands of organizations, states, groups that would only have been dreaming of this stuff in the 1990s.
I want to now do a segue between, if you like, current conflicts and what we're learning from them and potential future conflicts by looking at something which always seems to be latent, which is the developing threat from an incredibly well-armed China. What might a conflict in that kind of area? Let's not just imagine a kind of US-China conflict, because I presume that has all kinds of nuclear potential consequences. But otherwise, a conflict in that area look like? I mean, large naval element, I imagine, Emma.
The most probable scenario is going to be China trying to invade Taiwan to take Taiwan back. And of course, that's going to be a huge naval element because Taiwan is across the sea from China. So China has to get its forces from mainland China over the Taiwan Strait to the island. And the Taiwan Strait is quite a narrow waterway. So that kind of theatre of operations is going to be quite small, but it's going to be very, very heavily naval. And I think the most important thing we're going to see from that, if that happens, is a lot of use of submarines, because submarines are stealthy and they have a lot of munitions on them. China has been building lots of submarines to try and compete with the US, the UK and other Western allies, and I think submarine warfare is going to have a resurgence that we haven't seen since probably the Second World War.
Shashank.
One important thing is we haven't discussed space. And of course, there's a sense that would be very important to any big power confrontation in the Pacific. China has watched America build a military system over the last 30 years that is dependent on data, data for targeting, data for communications, all sorts of things, a great deal of which is shuttled through or collected from satellites. China is not stupid. It knows that if you want to stop the American military machine, you need to dazzle, blind, jam, or if necessary, destroy a lot of those satellites. And a great deal of thinking around a war in the Pacific involves the question of, would the People's Liberation Army launch a first strike against American space assets? And what would that war in space look like?
Well, this is a very interesting question, Jack. Let's imagine for a moment that neither of the China nor the United States wants to get involved in a direct conflict, but they want to play it out maybe as has happened in Ukraine. Would the Chinese still want to try and interdict US satellites, which might very well be used to help the Taiwanese? And if they did, would that immediately be interpreted by the US as an act of war upon itself?
So it's worth noting that one of the first things that the Russians did when they invaded Ukraine was to launch cyber attacks against Viasat and a number of other constellations. And they've been attacking SpaceX and the Starlink network throughout.
That's and Elon Musk's operation.
Absolutely. And they've also been using electronic warfare against satellites. I think that would almost inevitably happen, because one of the things that the Chinese would want to do to Taiwan is to control the information environment. They wouldn't want an equivalent of Zelensky standing before the world on camera, doing his piece to camera, you know, rallying support. How do you cut off an island? You sever the undersea cables, but you also deny access to satellite communication. And you can do that without physically destroying the satellites. You can suppress them with electronic warfare. And so there would almost certainly be an element of space combat, as it were, in these kinds of scenarios. But again, there's a graduated ladder between effects that you can see and effects that you would immediately feel. One of the challenges, of course, is that Taiwan is the global hub for semiconductor manufacture. And so in any scenario where it's China versus Taiwan, there is probably a blockade, and that blockade will disrupt access to all of our civilian microelectronics, computing, etc., which means that everyone is immediately involved. You will feel the impact.
Okay, that sounds like fun. Emma?
I think the important thing to remember about space warfare is that if you destroy a satellite, like physically destroy it, the debris is still in orbit. So all that you have your satellite going around the Earth in the same orbit, and then you have lots of little tiny bits going around in that orbit. And the problem with that is that any one of those bits can hit your own satellites. So China is very unlikely to want to physically destroy satellites because they cannot predict where that debris is going to go, and they don't want to hit their own satellites or the satellites of a friendly country or the satellites of a country that might be really annoyed. So it's definitely going to be in the kind of cyber attack, electronic warfare spectrum rather than the physical warfare.
Unless, of course, they feel that the adversary depends more on space than they do. And we have seen decisions in the history of warfare where countries have embarked on potentially ruinous acts in, you know, the commons, including things like unrestricted submarine warfare, which are rooted in a decision that this is probably a bad idea. This could be a terrible idea, but it has potential military advantages in the here and now.
Well, the suggestion there is that that's something we would have to think about and possibly be prepared for. Can we move on from space to the question of automation and also the idea of artificial intelligence guided weapons and weapon systems? Jack, is this something that we should be thinking about now?
Absolutely. I mean, artificial intelligence is already used to automate a lot of targeting processes and data integration. There are computer assisted systems that allow weapons to guide on to targets without a human correcting their approach. And this will accelerate and expand. The use of it will increase. The only caveat I would point out is that you need to keep these weapons to a certain cost, and they need to be fairly robust so that you can't have them dependent upon vulnerable data links. And so their contextual awareness is quite limited, and they will follow behavioral logics that are pre-programmed based on their understanding of the context. Now, as soon as one of these AI-assisted weapons crashes and doesn't blow up, and I've worked doing this with weapons, Russian weapons mainly, and you take them apart, you can work out what their behavioral logic is. And as soon as you do that, you can then set up decoys, set up a context so that it thinks it's doing the sensible thing, but actually it's going to miss completely and fail as a weapon system. And so then you need to update the behavioral logic of the weapon. And so you still need people doing that updating. You still need people who understand competitive dynamics, who are working out how these things interact and monitoring whether or not they succeeded or not. It's not just the case that you can use automation to hand over fighting to robots.
Right. I want to come on to the ethics of it in a moment. But Emma, what Jack's saying suggests that there still is a very much a point in trying to keep a technological edge over your potential opponent.
Technological edge has been how wars have been won for centuries. I mean, whether that's having better arrows, better cannon, you know, it's the same thing over and over again. We see offensive attack technologies improve, the defensive technology then improves to counter that, the attack technology improves, and so on and so on. So this is just another iteration of that same pattern that we see in warfare. So having a technological edge over your adversary has always been important, but it will be particularly important now because so much of warfare is based on technology. So that becomes even more of a important thing.
Shashank, just before we come onto the ethics of it, that also suggests a kind of very different employment strategy for defence forces as to who they actually need.
It does. And I think that as you see more automated offensive weapons, you will first of all see greater automation in defence. That's part of it. But I think also, you know, when you look at what armies are asking soldiers to do, one of the questions is, how do they make equipment more intuitive and usable for soldiers at the ground level? Jack mentioned the tablet device that soldiers have accessible to see their situation around them. In the same way, as equipment becomes more complex, more technical, more advanced, you'll need to make sure that it can be employed and used by soldiers, you know, who understand how to equip and maintain it as well.
Well, what about decisions being taken at the point of the weapon itself, Emma? I mean, in other words, it is programmed to recognise a whole series of variables, and it therefore effectively may be taking the decision. I mean, can we start a discussion about what the problems and ethics of that might be?
The problem is where you assign the ethical decision to kill that target. So if you were to imagine that a missile with AI-guided automation hit a target, but it hit the wrong target and it killed 20 civilians, where is the ethical blame for that? Is it with the person who ordered that strike? Is it with the person who ordered the targeting? Is it with the person who programmed the AI? And where does that blame lie?
Jack, do you think people are actually because war is a brute business. Do you think people in armies are actually worried about that kind of ethical problem?
They're very worried about it. Soldiers are deeply concerned about the ethics of what they do. But I think we can also over-intellectualize this, because if we're talking about an autonomous weapon, a landmine is an autonomous weapon, right? It makes a very simple decision, yes or no, based on an input. And legally, who is responsible for who the landmine kills? The person who puts the landmine down, right? And whether they follow the rules about how they do that. So we have pretty good structures for managing this. People talk about runaway killer robots and all of this kind of thing. But actually, militaries are there to deliver political effect. They are there to achieve an objective. And in order to use military force to achieve an objective, they need to be able to control that force. They're very concerned about making sure that it's used efficiently against the right targets. And so most militaries don't want loose cannon robots roaming around all over the place. They want robots that reliably perform a task that they are assigned, and that task can be defined. So militaries are concerned about it, but I also don't think it's an unmanageable problem, and there's a lot of scaremongering going on.
I have a final question to ask each of you. I want you to imagine that I'm the new incoming Secretary of State for Defence, and we've got into a lift, and I said to you, I've got to get off of the fifth floor, but while we're in this lift, what should I be spending my defence budget on now and in the longer term? Shashank, what would you say?
I think the overarching point is do less, but do it better. In other words, don't just fixate on the number of platforms, the number of things you have, the number of formations. Ask yourself the really hard questions. Have I invested enough in the munitions that make them capable? Have I got the intelligence platforms that let a gun see where it needs to fire? Have I got expertise in electronic warfare that can allow my drone to penetrate contested airspace and get to where it needs to go? So in other words, less bean counting and more really tough assessment of military capability.
Emma.
I think my point would be don't over-rely on magical new technology. There seems to be, in a lot of defence ministries around the world, a thought that technology will solve all of our problems and we will have all this wonderful weaponry that will do things beautifully. And my point would be stick to, as well, the things that we do traditionally. You will still need ships, you will still need submarines, you will still need tanks, you will still need artillery. Don't forget that when looking at these beautiful new technologies that are coming out.
I think very specifically within the UK Ministry of Defence, number one, we need to sort out our industrial base so that we can sustain large amounts of ammunition consumption. We have to do that in the short term so that we can continue to supply Ukraine, but we also need it for NATO so that we can deter Russia in the future. If you want to stop Russia, it doesn't matter if you're really, really efficient at destroying their tanks. If you've only got enough ammunition to destroy five, that doesn't deter the Russians. So that's number one. And number two is we currently face a real challenge with the offer to our soldiers and aviators and sailors in terms of their career structure, pay and retention. And we need to get that sorted, because if you can't keep the people, then it doesn't matter how sophisticated your weapons are. You know, you need operators to use them.
Right. So the nice thing about recording this in front of an audience is that we can take some of your questions. And if you'd like to put your hand up if you want to ask something, and we'll try and get a microphone to you. The gentleman in the middle here had his hand up so quickly when that came that I kind of, it's. I think I'm going to give the benefit to agility.
Thank you. Thank you. The experts, where do you see the strategic differentiation coming in the war in Ukraine? How important do you think strategically will be the release of the long-range weaponry from the US and Germany?
Jack.
So long-range fires are extremely useful because you can reach out and strike command posts, logistic hubs. Nothing is safe, right, from the enemy's point of view. But the effect that that has on the enemy army is not decisive. It doesn't destroy them. It just slows down or limits their ability to coordinate or concentrate resources. And so whether those systems are going to be significant is less about them and more about how can the Ukrainians exploit the effect that those munitions have. How can they use the disruption to Russian command and control, logistics, etc., to achieve something that shifts the logic of the conflict? And they may well be able to do it, But it's not as simple as give the long-range weapons and then success. It requires how do you leverage those long-range fires.
Right, I will take another question. There's a gentleman right there on the left-hand side who's doing more. I'm sorry, sir, that you're not waving vigorously enough, but there's a man who is.
Hello. Could the panel conceive of a place for NATO in helping in Gaza, because the UN are in a difficult position there? And I wonder what the panel could conceive with NATO somehow being formed to allow Israel to pull back, to protect the civilians and take over.
Could we reformulate your question very slightly, if you don't mind me doing this, which is there anybody internationally who would have the military capacity to act as a proper peacekeeping force in Gaza who could be enlisted to do it? Is there such a thing in existence, Shashank?
I'm very doubtful there is. From an Israeli perspective, the country that they trust, for example, in questions around a future Palestinian state or patrolling the Jordan River, is the United States. But of course, it's very difficult to envisage the US wanting to stick large numbers of troops in the West Bank or the Middle East right now, not least of all when it's engaged in these intense discussions over deterring China and other priorities. And of course, Arab states in the region don't want to put themselves in that situation unless they're pretty confident that it's in a political context that's leading to a viable two-state solution. So I'm really sceptical any outside power is willing to exert itself and take the risks in that way.
Until there looks like there's a viable peace, and then they might. Is what
that, but also there has to be a peace to keep. Peacekeeping is not about going in, and you know, if you still have to disarm Hamas, that's not an easy job, and we see the problems with that in southern Lebanon, where you have Hezbollah, a very powerful armed force that effectively is really more powerful than the Lebanese armed forces or UN peacekeepers, and peacekeepers are there really watching as Hezbollah wanders around firing rockets across.
Yes. There's a woman back there, about four rows down. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name's Lucy Reeve. I'm Chief of Staff at the HALO Trust. We're the world's largest organisation that clears landmines and unexploded ordnance from conflict-affected communities. And we also mitigate the risks of human suffering by managing weapons and ammunition. My question to the panel is, you describe the technological advances and the changes in the way that war is waged. How does that shape the way in which we build peace?
Emma, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think your job is going to become a lot harder. I really do, and especially with landmines. I mean, the landmines we're seeing coming out now are more sophisticated, they are more dangerous, and they will linger for longer. And this is the impact of technology. The more lethal it becomes, the more lethal it stays, and the more damage it does to civilians if it's used incorrectly. So I think your job is going to be a lot harder.
Emma, can you explain to us in what way they are more dangerous and more lethal?
So my personal experience is with naval mines, which is a slightly different thing. But the more advanced your technology becomes, the more ways you can build landmines to detonate. So you can plant them in different places, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan with IEDs along the sides of roads, and the more traditional landmines that we think of when you say the word landmine. But you can also have them to be detonated by someone stepping on them. You can have them detonated remotely by a mobile phone or some other signal, and you can hide them very effectively. And if you have big war fronts like in Ukraine, where there are lots of landmines around, the job of clearing them becomes much more difficult.
Can they be much smaller? And can they be made of materials that are much more difficult to detect?
Absolutely. You can make them out of plastic, so you can't detect them with metal detectors. You can have much smaller explosive charges that do a lot more damage. And you can have them connected together in a way that is not really seen at the moment. So you can have one person step on a mine and the whole thing goes off.
Jack Watling.
Firstly, thank you very much for the work of the HALO Trust, because it's absolutely critical, and the importance of institutions that are working to try and improve the situation is vital. But we are currently in a situation where there are quite a lot of countries who believe they can achieve their political objectives by starting wars, by using force. That is what the Russian government has concluded. It's what the Azeris, the Azerbaijan government, concluded in Nagorno-Karabakh. And it is increasingly important, if you do want to have peace, that we discredit the idea that you are going to improve the situation, the security of your own state, by embarking upon military campaigns, which unfortunately means that deterrence, the capacity to resist, is very important in dissuading those actors that want to use force from doing so. And so while I would like the answer to be that we can come to a consensus that peace is best, there is an element of deterrence and coercion in building that consensus.
Thank you. Right. I'm just going to make sure I'm looking around correctly. The gentleman in the white there has had his hand up for some time.
Good evening, Simon Bibby. I want to go back very briefly to the basics of logistics and supply lines. Mindful of the problems that Napoleon and Hitler had invading Russia and the ones the Ukraine are having with all the landmines we've just been talking about and what happened in last summer's non-events in the land war, given they're now getting control of the Black Sea, would an attack on the Kerch Bridge, taking out the whole length of the bridge, not just a small van blowing up a little bit that can be repaired, and presumably not a Poseidon missile that would probably miss anyway, but it would disrupt a huge part of the supply line to the Crimea and that part of the conflict in the Donbass region?
That's a very specific question. The Kerch Bridge is the bridge the Russians built, isn't it, between Russia proper and Crimea, which it annexed. I'm not in a position to evaluate that question, Shashank, but you may be.
Well, the destruction of the Kerch Bridge would obviously severely complicate Russian logistics, both in the Crimean Peninsula, which is a strategic target for Ukraine, a place they've been striking very effectively to do great damage to the Black Sea fleet and its facilities, but also its logistics in southern Ukraine. I think the challenge, though, is, as Jack pointed out earlier with the question of long-range missiles, is what do you do with that disruption to logistics? It's not simply enough to let the Russians stew in their own problems. You have to take advantage of it somehow, whether that's by exploiting the chaos, trying to break through the front lines, trying to hit them somewhere else, hit their reinforcements while they move through alternative routes. You have to exploit these conditions. But I think that question's a really good occasion also just to mention the importance, again, of logistics as this critical thing that we have taken for granted for so long. America's way of war for so long was let's slowly build up our forces in a country or a port for months, as we did in 1991 in the Gulf War, as we did in 2003 with Iraq, and then attack with our concentrated strength. In a world where even mid-sized adversaries can fire big missiles at your ports, your railheads, your facilities, that just won't be possible. So this idea, what military planners call contested logistics, is becoming much, much more important to big Western militaries who are realising, hang on, we don't have the supply lines and facilities we thought we did. And we can laugh at the Russians, look how funny and awful they are at logistics, but I think we should ask ourselves very carefully, how would we fare in some of the same situations?
To which your answer seems to be, at the moment, not that well.
Well, let's look at the number of ports we rely on in Europe to surge American forces from across the Atlantic to Europe in a high-end war. How many of those ports are affected or influenced by computer systems by Russia or China or vulnerable to missile strikes or disruption?
So in previous wars, there were a relatively limited number of ways that you could get your information from places like the BBC, for example. And so it was relatively easy to have a consistent baseline of understanding. Still a lot of misinformation, far less information, but fewer channels. We're now in a situation where information, you can pick your own source. The sources are completely disaggregated. And so you end up with these isolated communities of knowledge who are not necessarily experts, don't necessarily have the skills to judge the veracity of what they're receiving, but can have really, really different understanding or conceptions of the ground truth, which makes it much harder to have a conversation about what's happening. And so in terms of your question about propaganda, I think before it was about trying to set master narratives, we're now seeing a environment in which you are trying to attack and co-opt groupings that you have fractured and broken away from the main body. It's kind of a disaggregated propaganda, as it were, which is much more targeted than a historical information environment that was more cohesive.
Shashank, as a man who is responsible for getting really good level information out there into this, what, cacophonous world?
I'm struck, David, by the fact that British Defence Intelligence, an organisation that was once a fairly modest department in Whitehall that was not publicity-seeking exactly, now publishes almost every day a tweet, if we're still allowed to call them that, an intelligence update on what's happening in Ukraine. These are statements of fact designed to try to influence the public. They're also an information operation designed to sway people's views of the conflict. And I think it's interesting how parts of the secret state that were once very shadowy, very cautious, certainly didn't spill their assessments into the public domain, have also become part of that propaganda war, of those information operations, with the specific intention of swaying views, rightly or wrongly, honestly or not, in various different ways. And that's exactly a recognition of the centrality of perceptions and the cognitive domain to this kind of war.
I think the term cognitive domain is a perfect point at which to end this programme. My thanks to Shashank Joshi, Dr. Emma Salisbury and Jack Watling. The Briefing Room will be back next week with the first in a special series of programmes on global democracy in the year of elections. I should also just point you in the direction of BBC Sounds, which not only includes all the past editions of The Briefing Room, but so many other things as well. Anyway, my thanks to the audience for their excellent questions. And from everyone at the Radio Theatre, all of us, goodbye.
Hello, it's Amol Rajan here.
And it's Nick Robinson, and we want to tell you about the Today podcast from BBC Radio 4.
Yes, this is where we go deeper into the sort of journalism that you hear on Today, exploring one big story with more space for insight and context.
We hear from a key voice each week, a leader in their field, be they a spy chief, a historian, a judge, a politician.
All with something unique to say, and we make sure they've got the time and space to say it.
The WhatsApps show the character of the men who were running our country at that point.
Trump is probably going to beat Joe Biden because he is a force of nature.
If the next scan says nothing's working, I might buzz off to Zurich.
We give you our take as well and lift the lid just a little bit on how the Today programme actually works.
That is the Today podcast. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
And subscribe.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.